What's it like when one of your friends on death row is led away to be executed?
You have a prepaid call from
William A. Papiro,
an inmate at the California State Prison, San Quentin. This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
I had to be a different completist guy, which is the guy who walked the walkways of San Quentin death row and without a gang, without a group of people around me. It was just me.
Soon after you went into to be on death row, and you didn't really understand the prison workout system so much, but then he said, we're going to do 75 sets of it. To me, that seems extreme. So I'm wondering if there's a danger of overtraining, wearing yourself out so that you're...
No, that's actually funny. That's funny. I'll tell you why. That's a good one, man. I'll tell you why.
Welcome to Death Row Diaries. I am Matt Ralston.
And I am William Nagero.
And Bill, you wanted to talk about a guy. You've been reading a lot about this guy named Patrick Kearney, and he's known as the Trash Bag Killer, right?
Yes, he is known as the Trash Bag Killer. He's also was mistakenly identified at one point as the Freeway Killer. It's actually three different killers. Some of the victims were considered part of the Freeway Killer slayings, which there's only one Freeway Killer, and that is William Bonney, who was executed at San Quentin in 1996, becoming the first person who was executed by lethal injection. The other person who was also considered to be by law enforcement the serial killer called the Freeway Killer was Randy Kraft. So the three of them at one point were mistakenly identified as the Freeway Killer, but it was only one guy. But all these guys did prove to be serial killers, and all of them were extremely prolific.
Yeah, and this guy Kearney is prolific, very efficient, very very good at what he does, assuming the goal is to keep doing it. And also some of these other guys get intertwined in this story, which is interesting. So we'll talk about that. First, I want to remind everyone to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Death Row Diaries, as well as subscribing on Patreon to patreon.com/Death Row Diaries, where you get bonus episodes, all kinds of stuff. And speaking of which, a couple subscribers sent us a few questions on Patreon. So if you guys have any questions, go ahead and hit me up, and I will get those to Bill and we'll address them. And this is an interesting question that Trevor sent in. And it's interesting because he says, Bill, are there any people you've met in prison that you know or strongly suspect are innocent? And I think it's an interesting question because if you're a lawyer, you probably wouldn't answer that, because to say that you know someone's innocent means that the other people you know probably aren't. Right, so you can answer this however you choose.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, luckily for you guys, I'm not an attorney, and the truth is I have not run across that many people, well, hardly anyone who was innocent. And what I mean by that is, to really find a person who was accused of crime and this person had absolutely nothing to do with it is rare. You know, the system does have its flaws, but it's probably the best system there is in the world. So I can't definitively tell you that I know an innocent person. I've run across people who said they're innocent. Good example. Scott Peterson says he's innocent. You know, I knew him or I know him. Whether I know he's innocent or not is a whole different story. But most guys in prison say they're innocent. The ones that actually are is an extremely small percentage, and especially for charged with murder. Now, we know that there are shortcuts that law enforcement takes sometimes, and that leads to suspicions that the police made a mistake or they did it on purpose, they set the guy up. Some of the times, most of the times, the cops are, it's like O.J. Simpson's case, okay? Like, everybody knows he did it. I mean, anybody that doesn't think he did it is an idiot. But police, Mark Furman, specifically, he cheated. He wanted to slam dunk the case. And that's where things went haywire. So OJ was found to be not guilty when in fact he is guilty. And the reason was because a crooked cop named Mark Furman planted evidence. That's a problem when you have to rely on law enforcement to give you the evidence as being real, and they're actually making it up. So, long story short, I have not met many people in prison that are completely innocent. Sometimes they're there, sometimes they witnessed it, sometimes they were in the car with a person, maybe they didn't pull the trigger, but for the most part, from what I have found, most of the people in prison are guilty in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good way of saying it, because even a couple guys that when we've talked about, we think maybe they were innocent, but they still did something, okay? That maybe they didn't murder someone, but they were engaged in something no good. And I think a couple good examples that we did episodes on would be Tommy Thompson. That was an early episode. And Tookie Williams.
Yeah, Tommy Thompson more to the point. Because you had two people involved, and David Leitch and Tommy Thompson, of course, were at one point both arrested for the same murder. Tommy Thompson said, look, I'm innocent, and this is the reason why. David Leitch, on the other hand, had more money, more political power. He ended up getting second-degree murder, which was 15 to life. Tommy Thompson, we all know, was executed. So, yeah, that's a pretty good example there of a case that a person who possibly could have been innocent of the crime he was convicted of. However, he was there. He was involved, just not to the extent that, well, David Leitch proclaimed.
Yeah, and if you're looking for examples, I always point to Cameron Todd Willingham, who was executed in Texas, and I think it's almost kind of a consensus, close to a consensus, that they executed an innocent person. So if anyone's not aware of that, there's an awesome New Yorker article and other stuff about that. Thank you for the question, Trevor. Derek asks, hey Bill, we're getting to March Madness time. We just had the Super Bowl. Is there anyone in prison that you're aware of that's running a bookmaking operation?
It's actually, yeah, the short answer is absolutely. Every place I have been, there is a pool going on. People bet every week in the NFL season, the basketball season, especially during March Madness. People run pools. People run betting little rings, and you know, you can make a pretty nice penny. I'm one of the guys who used to bet a lot in the NFL, not so much in college because it's so unpredictable, especially during March Madness. But I did do a lot of betting on the NFL, and I was pretty good. I hit the pool on death row, I think more than 10 times in about a 5-year span. And that's pretty good because the pool, you get paid in stamps and you get paid in hygiene items and in food. It's not the same thing as getting, $100,000 from a bookmaker. But, hey, it paid the bills and it was pretty cool. And I'm always up for some friendly gambling when it comes to sports.
So you might still be participating in this kind of stuff. So is it based on credit, or do you front the money like you would do in a Vegas sports book, or how does it work?
Yeah, well, on death row, I have not been involved in any of that gambling stuff because I like to watch sports. I just don't gamble anymore. I really don't have the time with all the stuff I'm doing, but because you really have to dedicate yourself to that. You got to study hours upon hours every day so you don't lose your shirt. But yeah, you would pay up more, normally with stamps, books of stamps. Cost whatever they cost, and you'd pay in, and you'd get a certain amount of tickets for a book of stamps. And if you hit, if you win the pool, you might get 150 books of stamps. And there's ways of getting rid of them. This guy's in prison who will pay 8, full price, but they'll pay you cash, and then you can buy food items or whatever. So it's a nice little pastime in prison.
Gotcha. All right, let's pick this up when you come back. Bill Caroline wrote in, and she asked if you know of a gentleman. Well, I don't know if he's a gentleman. You'll have to tell me. But a guy by the name of Jarvis J. Masters. And she says, what do you think of his work, his case, his chances of exoneration?
Yeah, I know Jarvis really well. He went by the name of Left Hand, and I've known him for probably almost 40 years. He wrote a couple of books. Don't know how well they did. One of them was That Bird Has My Wings. And we were in the same yard for many years. And we were also in the hole for a very long time. When I first got to the Adjustment Center in 1988, he was in the hole, and he spent about 25 years in the hole. So, yeah, I know him really well. I've not read his books, although I had a lot of conversations with Jarvis when I was first thinking about writing my first book, which was Escape Artist. And through some of the conversations he and I had, I was able to really guide myself through the world of literary agents and publishers to get the book finally published. And so Jarvis and I have had a pretty good relationship. I know him, as I said, very well. And whether he's innocent or not, that's, you know, he's still going through an appeal process, and I would hate to comment on that particular case because it involves California Department of Corrections officers. There was actually an officer who lost his life. But as in most cases in prison, it's always a he said, she said. Jarvis was never accused of actually being the person who killed anyone. Some other informant informed on him and said a bunch of things. Now, that guy I know has changed his story a number of times. Jarvis has always maintained his innocence to me. So I don't know. You know, like I said, people ask me, do you know anybody that is innocent? And my response is, I know a lot of people who have claimed their innocence. I don't know for sure. He not being a serial killer, I never really paid much attention to him otherwise that he was always a gentleman with me. You mentioned he was a gentleman. He was. He always spoke eloquently. He's a Buddhist. He's a, and he's also, actually, there's been a book written about him called A Buddhist on Death Row. And it was written by another author. And I believe that Oprah Winfrey did a book club of him, of the book. And I think it did really well. So all I can say about Jarvis is that he and I have always gotten along rather well. He's always comported himself as a professional, as an author, and really I consider him to be a friend. And that's hard to say in prison because I've never considered many people my friends. I say an acquaintance, but he's always been very forthcoming with me when I asked him a question when I was first entering the literary world. And he was very forthright as well as forthcoming with me in helping me guide through that world. So I appreciate his help, and I wish him always the best. He is a guy who spent a lot of time in prison, and I hope that he gets a fair shake.
All right, so I know you're really interested in this Patrick Kearney guy. And when I take a look at this guy, man, the first thing I thought was you always talk about blending in, about how some of these guys, the good ones or most of them, I would say, are the more successful ones. They blend in. Like, I think you were talking about Naso, who we've talked about, and how if you looked at him, your eye wouldn't linger on him for 1 second. You just notice him, and maybe you wouldn't. Like, you'd noticed him, but you wouldn't remember him. And that's the impression I get with this Kearney guy. Like, he's just so average seeming and forgettable.
Well, the one thing that's struggling about Kearney that's is so noticeable, actually, because with a guy like Naso and some of these guys, yeah, you just pass them right up. You don't think about them. With this guy, you actually think, huh, this guy's not a danger to anybody. He's so unassuming. He wears glasses. He looks like a little Poindexter. He's a little guy. This is the guy that you would underestimate, which is different from a guy like, say, Naso, who, you know, is 5'10", not really the kind of guy that you would ever look at again because he looked like an average Joe. But this guy, he's the kind of guy that you would judge a book by its cover. You would look at him and say, this guy's not a danger even to a fly.
Well, what size is this guy?
And that would be a mistake, wouldn't it?
I mean, how atypical? Because I read that he's small a few times, but so you're saying he's so small that you actually notice, like, wow, that's like a tiny guy.
Well, not so much his stature, but the way he looks. His hair is parted to the side. He has wear little glasses. He looks like Poindexter. And most guys that I know, tough guys that I know, would look at him and just immediately just say, this guy ain't shit. And just because he believe or you believe that you can walk right through this guy. But this guy was bright. A lot of people have made a lot of comments about this guy being a genius, that he had 180 IQ. Everything that I have read about him doesn't tell me that he has 180 IQ. 180 IQ is extremely high. Rodney Outlaw, the serial killer with the highest IQ I've ever run across, had 170. And that is genius level. This guy, they're saying he has 180. He worked for Hughes Aircraft as an engineer. I don't know if all that is true about him. I know that one thing for sure, he was extremely dangerous and extremely proficient as a serial killer.
Yeah, yeah. He's from East LA, which I think back then was obviously still heavily Mexican, so he spoke Spanish. I heard he spoke four languages. Don't know if that's true. Anytime I hear that, I'm like, what does that mean? Like, can you say a few sentences? Yeah, are you Melania Trump? You know how to say $200? So I don't know. But you know, he's growing up in an area where there's a lot of immigrants, a lot of access to disadvantaged people, and he's speaking Spanish. So he's got that going for him. And, you know, most white guys aren't smart enough to learn Spanish. Like, even if they live in a Mexican... Well, I'm saying if they live in a Mexican neighborhood, what percentage of white guys even know any Spanish? Pretty little, right?
Well, in some cases, yeah. We don't want half the guys in L.A. coming after you that are white. They want to beat you up now, Matt. But, yeah, so... With this guy, you know, he comes from a middle-class family. You know, he's a bad guy. You know, he is considered a serial killer, a necrophiliac, which means he has sex with corpses. He's a pedophile. He has a killing spree that lasts between 1962 and 1977 that police know about. He is suspected of killing 21 guys he was convicted of murdering. They think that number is well into the 30 to 38 to 40 range. And I believe that to be true as well. But this guy starts off as, like, as you mentioned, East LA, speaks Spanish, middle class family. There's no abuse in that family. He is not being molested by his father or his uncle or his cousin. Goes to school, good students. But he gets teased, and he gets teased like most of us got teased. With him, the word queer used to come up a lot. And remember, kids that are young, 8, 9, 10 years old, they notice differences in kids. They're very in touch with their instincts. And usually a young kid, when he sees somebody, he says something, there's a bit of truth somewhere in it. And in this case, there was. They used to call him, you know, bad names. Names that today would get a kid probably stuck in prison, but they'd call him queer. They'd call him fag. They'd call him all these derogatory names that we don't use today. And I can imagine how that would make a child feel. But that's the only bullying or abuse that I can come up with. I've read everything I can on this guy, and I have found nothing else. But listen to this, Matt. Very early on, he starts fantasizing of killing, of skinning people. And it's people he hates. He also, very early on, begins to sexualize the control and domination. And as a preteen, he starts engaging in bestiality. So this guy is a prime example of a person who's born this way. He's wired this way. I mean, you know, look, I got teased as a kid. I got called horrible names because of my skin color, because of how I looked. And I don't remember ever fantasizing of killing or skinning or sexually raping people because they upset me. Now, I will admit that when people would beat me up, I would, you know, I would picture myself as the Fonz with a leather jacket, and people would be afraid of me. And those are the kind of fantasies I had because I was tired of being bullied. But they never turned into what this guy does. And I was beat up a lot, and I was teased a lot. So I'm kind of looking at this guy, and I say, wow, this guy is fantasizing about killing people at the age of 8. He is, in his mind, skinning them alive, dismembering them. That's a big jump for an 8-year-old boy.
Yeah, and not to be politically incorrect, and I was teased as well and messed with by tough kids or whatever, but if you said that kids can kind of sense things, they're pretty in touch on a base level with things. Yeah, if you're having sex with dogs or whatever, the kids can pick up on that you're a weirdo. I'm going to go out and say you actually deserve to be teased, if not worse. You know, there's something really wrong with you. I mean, how progressive could we ever be that someone that engages in bestiality, that you're not going to be able to recognize that they're weird and that no one's going to comment on it? It's never going to happen. This guy's always going to be teased, you know, in life.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very interesting because kids really early on finger him immediately for what he is. He's different. There's something wrong with him. There's something completely creepy about this guy. And it's interesting because even at the age of 8, already he's developing his method and discovering who he is. Remember, I've mentioned this before, that some of them start very early. They may not exercise murdering, but they're already developing their MO. Let me call back.
To accept this call, say or dial 5 now. Thank you for using Global Tail Link.
Hey, Matt.
Yeah, so do you think that Kearney understands that he's gay early on, or because that seems to become pretty relevant to his MO, his killing.
Yeah, and there's something to be said about that. I believe that this kid knew who he was, and what I mean who he was, not that he was just gay, but that he really, the fantasy of killing appealed to him. He got a rush out of it. Most of these serial killers, as they're killing and how they speed up, is because the rush. And I've talked about this rush before. With him, you can see it very early on. He is, and there's been a lot made of this. There are different reports that mention different things. He worked at a pig farm, that he was murdering pigs. And then he would basically take off his clothes and, you know, allow the pigs blood all over them. He would come swim in their intestines. This is stuff that has been written about him. I don't know if that's actually true about him, but what is true about him is that when he begins to kill, dismembering, opening up stomachs, to see, because he's curious about the insides of people, is something huge for this guy. And he's not the kind of guy who just rape his victims. He kills them first because he likes to have sex with corpses. He's a necrophiliac. That makes him different than the other men that were killing at that time in Southern California, I mean, Randy Kraft and William Bonney. other guys were considered the so everything with him was post-mortem. He killed a person and then had sex. Now, there's a few things you can think about that when it comes to this particular killer. So let's talk about that. So when it comes to homosexual serial killers, most of them are especially sadistic. And that's an interesting topic. So because of homophobia in America, in American society, which sometimes causes gay men to grow up with a deep-seated sense of self-hatred and of violence towards their own homophobia, I believe that a guy like Kearney, with these feelings prevalent, especially prevalent in the 60s and 50s when he was growing up, combined with just the psychology of a serial killer, the results then are what you have with the trash bag killer or the trash bag murders. You have a man who's extremely sadistic. He's murdering these people, but also as he murders them, remember, his MO is very unique too. He recognizes who he is and his place in the food chain when it comes to strength and his overall ability to control a victim. So he gets the victim in the car, he takes him over to a club, he takes him over to hitchhiking, which he did numerous times. And he'll be driving along, his left hand on the steering wheel, controlling the car, making sure he's not going over the speed limit. And suddenly he produces a gun, and without the victim knowing it, puts it to the side of their head and pulls the trigger, killing them instantly. He slumps them over on the car and then drives to a location where, a secluded location, where he can then have sex with the corpse. He then normally takes it home with him, and there he dismembers the body, cuts it up into small pieces, drains the blood, washes the body with soap to leave less hair fibers, and then he goes and dumps it. What this tells me is that he understands that the gun is his equalizer. He understands that he just cannot forcefully take on another man because of his stature and because how he really is. He's not very confident in his physical ability. So he kills him immediately. Now he has violent sex with the corpse. He cuts it up, and he sometimes leaves the bodies intact, and then he beats the body up with a baseball bat, with his fists, whatever way he can. This tells me he's exploring the depths of his rage and what he hates. What he hates is that he was taught from a very young child to hate or to have homophobia, and he self-loathes himself. So he's beating up the body, he's doing dismembering it, all because of what he was taught as a child is to hate himself. It's a psychology of that added with the psychology of a serial killer, which he's wired to do from birth. Well, actually, if you think about it, he's actually wired for both. Homosexuality is not something you pick up later, and like some of these guys that you can pray yourself out of, or you can just abstain from it. You're still gay, okay? And he was wired that way from birth. This is what I don't understand, why these so-called experts have never understood when I say serial killers are born. They're wired that way. It's just, and I'm not by any way, shape, or form suggesting that serial killers and homosexual men are the same thing. But when they're combined together, they have a particular appalling result. A serial killer as well as a homosexual who now hates himself and he's taking on these victims. But the point is that homosexual men are wired that way from birth. A serial killer is wired that way from birth. What is so difficult of understanding that? That he was wired to kill.
Yeah, right. I agree. So I read, and I don't know how much this is just good storytelling, something that belongs in a script, but that he would pick his victims based on who they reminded him of, bullies, or they physically resembled certain bullies, or basically that he would pick jocks and popular looking guys, cool guys, and that was him projecting it onto the people that hurt him when he was younger. What do you think about that?
You know, that's a psychologist coming in, and he wants to be correct. He wants people to understand that he understands how this guy thinks. Look, could they have resembled something? Sure. I'm sure if I walked down the street and threw a baseball into a crowd, I'll hit somebody that I thought probably didn't like me. Look, I don't believe that's true. For him to find victims that reminded him of people that picked on him is almost ridiculous, because remember, this guy picked people that hitchhiked. He was randomly picking them. It was an opportunistic, he found these people in a way that was just because of opportunity presented itself. And here's my biggest push against these so-called experts who say that. This guy also murdered 13-year-old children, 8-year-old children, and 5-year-old children. How the hell does a 5-year-old child remind you of someone that bullied you? It's ridiculous what some of these people say to sell a book or to get other people to listen to them. And look, and I call it out as I see it. You know me well enough, Matt. I hate bullshitters. And when a guy tells me, well, look, you know, he did this, you don't know he did it that way, for that reason. And I tend to go away from that. Could somebody have reminded him? Sure. But did it really happen that way? No. I think it was more the gender. He beat these bodies up the way he did. He did what he did because he was self-loathing in a way. And some of the times, he got in fights with his lover. So he would leave, pick up one of these guys. That was the trigger for him. And then he'd go out and do what he does. It's that simple.
So
sometimes people overthink this stuff.
Oh yeah, I didn't believe that when I heard it. That's not how stuff works. But is he? Do you figure he's picking men he's attracted to? I don't know how a necrophiliac really, you know, when they're smitten with someone, how that works. But or do you think it doesn't matter? It's just opportunity.
Well, I think that both things play into the part. Look, he runs across a Marine or a guy who he sees at a club. The guy's willing to get in the car. He sees a child on the road hitchhiking. He picks him up. Those are all opportunistic things. It would be different if Patrick Kearney went out to bars, he saw a guy, he followed him home, he stalked him for several weeks, and then went into his window and then killed him. Well, that's an organized killer. As intelligent as Patrick Kearney is, or what he actually is, he's probably 85 years old, 84 years old right now. He's at Mule Creek Prison, unless he died very recently, that I don't know about, but he's still in Mule Creek Prison. So, look, it really depends on the circumstances of how these victims came to him. He really didn't have much cooling periods. He does mention that he killed his first person in 1962. And one of the persons that he caught killed, he buried him right where he lived. Later on, he took police there, and sure enough, there's the body. You know, he says he kind of killed between 1962, he killed 3 people, and then he kind of skipped a few years. I don't believe that to be true. Because, as we know, serial killers have victims that they don't want to share. There's a reason why they don't want to share that person. All the people that they kill are monumental moments to them. They're very important. That's why these guys keep clippings. That's why these guys follow police. They want to know what's going on, how famous they're becoming. But sometimes, as we saw on the Mad Baker, or the Killing Baker in Alaska, he shared 17 of his kills with police. The other that were, I think, in the totals of the 30s, he didn't want to share them. He wouldn't give any details. That is a serial killer keeping things to himself. Patrick Kearney does something similar to that. I don't believe he killed in 1962 and then stopped till 1968 or 69. And then I don't believe that.
Right. So what we do know is, according to him, that for a long period of time, he was either picking up hitchhikers or picking up guys in gay bars and killing them for about once a month for a sustained period of time, and then doing all the other stuff that you said, and I guess, you know, dumping their bodies.
Yeah, exactly. And look, this guy had... Remember I mentioned earlier that this guy knew who he was very early? Right. This is some of the evidence that I base it on. Not only because of my experience with serial killers and asking these direct questions, but because of what he does. Patrick Kearney was a huge fan of another serial killer that you and I both have discussed, Matt, and that is Dean Carroll. He was known as the Candyman. Well, Patrick Kearney studied him carefully, reading about sometimes wrapping them in trash bags, how he buried them. Remember, Patrick Kearney also read about Dean King's propensity to bury people in locations that he knew. Well, Kearney did the same thing. So he also collected newspaper clippings and news and torture of the conclusions of Carroll's crimes and how his accomplices killed him. So this guy was pretty well, I guess, informed about what serial killers do. He knew he was a serial killer because once he killed, that rush was something that nothing else took him to. So he began to read about other serial killers. One of them was the Candyman, who was also homosexual, was a pedophile, loved boys, young boys, as well as teenagers. And you see a guy finding his niche and then running with it. And that's what we have with the trash bag murder guy, who's known as Patrick Kearney. And actually, we should talk about how the police took this case as well. And I'll tell you why this case probably more than likely lasted as long as it did, meaning his spree. And it's because law enforcement basically didn't care too much about the homosexual community. I'll be back.
You have a prepaid call. You will not be charged for this call. To accept this call, say or dial 5 now. Thank you for using Global Tel Link.
Hey, Matt.
Yeah, well, Bill, isn't it... I think we're missing one piece here, though. So he was studying... He was studying the Candyman, Dean Carroll. But, so you know how in the 70s, George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, Francis Ford Coppola, they're all at USC Film School. They're sharing ideas, they're sharing thoughts. They have a friendly rivalry with each other to push each other to be better at what they're doing and more, you know, creative and prolific. And you have Kearney frequenting these Southern California gay bars, you know, the mecca of like serial killer like territory at that time. And isn't he rubbing elbows with some of these other guys as well?
He is, and he actually knew who Randy Kraft was. These clubs that he frequented were also some of Randy Kraft's hunting grounds. And it's very interesting you bring that up, Matt, because when he was ultimately arrested, the police department, from the very beginning, it's not just one police department, it is Southern California. He went from different counties, and he killed a number of different people. But they were very curious to know why he was sticking cactuses and wooden stakes and clothing and underwear into the rectum of his victims. And Kearney looked at them like they were crazy, like, what the hell are you talking about? And they kept pressing him that, you know, why he was, you know, biting off the testicles of his victims and why he was doing, and again, and then suddenly during the interview, he stops and it dawns on him. And his response to the police department or the officers who were interrogating him, because remember, he confessed, and I'll tell you the reason he confessed, which is very interesting. But he looks at them and he tells them, I'm not the wooden stake. Like, you bunch of dumb shits. I'm not that guy. I'm this guy, and this is what I do. And what he was referring to was that he was not Randy Kraft, because he knew Randy Kraft was doing all these murders where he would mutilate the person while he was alive. He'd torture them. He would put cigarette burns all over the bodies. He would, you know, castrate them. He'd put things in their rectums. He just really just destroyed the body as the person was alive, so he would scream. That's not what Kenny did. Kenny would shoot him, and then he would dismember the body and do all kinds of crazy stuff to him, which is to have sex. He'd copulate the bodies. It's just really weird-ass stuff. But he was insulted that the police would consider him to be Randy Kraft.
Wait, so is he following this kind of through the news, or are they like, you know, when a truck driver sees another truck driver and they know who each other are, they give each other a nod? I mean, had they like discussed these things, or is he just kind of aware of it from you know, a tangential perspective?
Well, and again, I know this because I've had these discussions with Randy Kraft. Randy Kraft knew who this guy was, and Kearney knew who this guy was, and they knew that they were both predators. They never associated with each other. They never killed together, but they knew who each other were.
Mm-hmm. Crazy.
And that's something you're not going to hear anywhere else, because I've had these conversations with Randy Kraft, and that's exactly what Randy Kraft told me when I asked him about this guy. And when I said, the genius serial killer, he just scoffed. His reply was, yeah, okay. That was his reply.
So they may have never spoken.
But they knew each other.
But they could recognize one of their own.
Oh, no. No. They spoke. Mm-hmm. They knew each other.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And do you think Kearney took offense? I mean, was it a point of pride that he wasn't doing these things and that he was simply shooting them and wrapping them in bags? Or, I mean, why was he really drawing the distinction? Or, you know what I mean?
Well, because they weren't his kills.
Right.
They weren't his kills. He wanted only credit for what he did. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't want to be considered a guy who did. See, with these serial killers, what they do is what they do, and they want credit for their actions. They don't want to be lumped in with a bunch of other guys. One of the things that William Bonning told me he hated was that they were considering all these other killers to be the freeway killer when he was the freeway killer. And it was a sense of pride for him. He actually looked over at Randy Kraft because they were in the same yard together. He says, yeah, they thought that clown was me. And but, I wasn't. Yeah.
But they're on the same freeway.
Yeah, they made those distinctions. Yeah.
Yeah. So how does Kearney eventually get caught?
Well, I mean, he makes mistakes. And the mistakes really come down to his lover. He had met David Hill in 1968. You know, they both were previously married. They were just faking. They met, you know, David Hill was a big guy, 6'2", athletic. He used to color his hair different colors. Look, and I don't know how to put this in a less graphic way or in a way that's not going to insult anybody, but David Hill was a man whore. And Kearney really got upset with some of his actions. That's what triggered him to go on. And the trash bag murders, the investigation really didn't officially get going until April 13, 1975. The reason it took so long, because he started in 1962, was because they were gay men. It's like when we talk about sex workers. Cops don't pay a lot of attention to it. They don't, they're high-risk occupations. They'll be all right, or no one really cares. With this case, when it became part of the homosexual community, it was a problem. Cops didn't want to get involved. They didn't really care. But when it finally got going, the cops are making horrible comments, Matt. I mean, about that community. They'd say, they call these murders instead of the trash bag murders, because they realized the guys, of course, with detective work, they found out the body they did find that they were gay. So they used to call them the fag in the bag murders. That's quoting police officers. The fag in the bag murders, instead of calling it the trash bag murders. So this is something that's going on. And of course, David Hill, before they're arrested, and I mentioned this before, this guy killed some children. And he really didn't have a type, but you tell me. So he kills a kid, Ronald Dean Smith, and the child is 5 years old. He disappears from Lenox, California on October 24th, 1974, and he's discovered October 12th, 1974. And then on June 16th, 1976, Michael McGee, 13, of Redondo Beach, was hitchhiking, and Kearney picked him up. He invited him on his camping trip, and then he ended up just shooting him in the head because the kid was a known criminal. And the truth is, Kearney felt threatened by this kid. And what he told police was, I disposed the body. You're not going to find him. And that is a problem for me, because you have a guy who is obviously gay, but he's also taking children as well. So he's changing everything he does. We've seen other serial killers who are pedophiliacs, and they also rape women. Well, this guy's the same thing. He likes sex with men, young boys, and with children. Mixed bag of tricks. How he gets caught is his boyfriend. David Hill invites a young kid who is also his lover to his house. And from what all the reports I have read, this young man, who was very young, we're talking 16, 17 years old, and what happens is that Kearney opens the door, and there is John Otis LeMay. He's only 17, actually. And he invites him into the house. Unfortunately for Kearney, LeMay tells his neighbor that he's going to Redondo Beach to meet a man named David. And they had met at a local gym. Well, the police were already investigating this stuff, and they started looking around for a guy named David, and they came upon David Hill, and that he lived with a man named Kearney. For some reason, and I believe that I'm correct in this, Kearney got jealous that this kid was coming over the house, and he was actually his lover's other lover. And without provocation, Kearney pulls out a pistol and shoots the man in the back of the head. And then he dismembers the corpse and dumps it in the desert. This is the case that brings the police to his front door and really gets him caught. The investigation begins to look at the name that regularly appears in sign-ins at sheets of gay bathhouses, and that name is David Hill. And then they go to his home, which Hill and Kearney welcome him in, and they're asking about this boy. They both are totally innocent. They don't know what's going on. They say, we'll help you in any way we can, but investigators are actually collecting fibers from that they found in a trash bag, and they're comparing it to the fibers of the carpet in the home. When they test them, the fibers match. So as soon as the cops leave Kearney's house, he begins to destroy all the documents he has on the Candyman, Dean Carroll. And then the police come back, and now they want hair fibers, pubic hair fibers, from both Kearney and Hill. And they cooperate. Well, all the fibers matched evidence left on LeMay's body. And then when the cops get a search warrant to come back, these two killers disappear. And I'm going to mention, I say killers in plural, because I don't want people to believe, okay, there's another killer. Tierney is a killer. But David Hill assisted in some of those murders. I know that once he was arrested, because he turned himself in, people, he went to Texas, but they knew who they were looking for. There was already an FBI report, a bulletin up. Friends of them said, look, turn yourselves in. They turned themselves in, and they indict Tierney because he confesses to 21 murders. He just tells them, this is what's going on. That is too simple, ladies and gentlemen. The reason that Tierney confessed to everything himself and said that he did it when David was gone, it was him protecting his lover. He hated him sometimes, and that's why he went out and did what he did, but he was completely in love with this guy. And he saved him. A jury, a grand jury, did not indict David Hill. Mostly because Tierney copped to every murder at first 21. His killing number is probably closer to 50 than the 21 he was convicted of, because later on they attached another 7 to him, and then they even put more to his body counts. So we can guess about 38. I'm willing to bet it's a lot higher, because between 1962 and 1968 he was killing, and there's not much record of that.
Yeah, I mean,
that's how he got caught.
Of course Hill was aware of it, because the last murder, he shot the guy in front of him, and he doesn't go to the cops. You don't think if I'm in a relationship and someone murders someone in front of me that I'm not alerting the authorities? I mean, give me a break. That means he was turning a blind eye the whole time. Or in fact, when you get back, I want to know if they were doing sadistic stuff together.
Okay, be right back. Hey, man.
Yeah, so what do you think?
Well, I think that they were both involved, and I think that part of that, this guy, Tierney, takes the victims to the house. Remember, Tierney is the bread maker. He's making the money. He makes, I believe it was in the 1960s, he was making about $20,000 a year, which is a pretty good amount of money. The other guy, David Hill, he was basically, well, the wife, he would just clean the house, and then he'd go to these bars and have sex with men, and it was pissing off Tierney. That he brought these guys to the house and dismembered them, cut them up there, you can't do that in a few minutes. Where was David Hill at? He was involved. Look, make no mistake, Tierney is the driving force behind these murders. But David Hill was involved. He says that David Hill was not there when he killed DeMay. But let me tell you something. When the police went back to the house, they found on a hacksaw blade fresh bits of blood and tissue. And they were LeMay's blood and tissue. They found residual blood all over the bathroom. They weren't clear to the naked eye, but with forensic liquids, they immediately popped up. All this stuff tells me that if he's doing this in the house, David Hill's involved. David Hill cleans the house. He does all the things to the house. There's no way you can dismember a body in a house and the person who lives there doesn't know about it. That's ridiculous. But it was a nice little package for them. Tierney copped to all the murders. He gave them locations. He took them to Santa Barbara, where he let them know where the body, they nearly dug the bodies up of George from 1968, and they found the body there. He gave them everything they needed to put a nice little bow on this and seal this case. His, what he wanted back, that his lover not be charged.
But there's a scenario.
They gave him.
There's a scenario where David Hill is tolerating this. He's disgusted by it. He puts up with it because it's his meal ticket. Also, by the way, criminal, you know, but there's another scenario,
right,
where he's, you know, watching him do it and masturbating, right? It's one of those two, basically.
I believe that he was participating in the murders. I believe he was a full participant. It wasn't that he was disgusted. Look, you could be disgusted because, you know, your girlfriend has flatulence at night. Hey, you might not leave because she's making the money. But if she's out there killing people and chopping off heads and all this stuff, at some point, you start weighing like, oh, okay, this is not a good situation. I could be next. Mm-hmm. So that tells me, because he was never next, he never thought he was going to be next, I believe that that is a big, tall sign. Now, remember, Randy Kraft also had a lover. Randy Kraft also had a male lover he lived with. But Randy Kraft, and this person, by the way, didn't know what Randy Kraft was doing. But Randy Kraft never took the victims to his house and dismembered them while the guy is there or not there at the moment, but later on comes home. You don't think in 10 years' time, somehow, this guy didn't come home early? And it's like, where the hell did all his blood come from? No. So Randy Kraft, of course, killed all his victims on the road, killed them under bridges, did all the sadistic things to them in fields, threw them, discarded their bodies in freeways. That's different. This guy, David Hill, absolutely an accomplice in all of this. And his lover, Kearney, covered for him. He took 21 life sentences. Now, a lot of people have made an issue of, well, he didn't receive the death penalty for these crimes, so he made a deal. That's actually not what happened. When these crimes happened, there was no death penalty in California. In 1977, when he was arrested, it was just going on the ballots for 1978. It's called the Briggs Initiative, 1977. It's called Proposition 7, and that includes the death penalty. So there was no death penalty to be had. The max they could give a person back then was life, which meant 7 years to life. Charles Manson had 7 years to life after they took the death penalty off of him. So he had the ability to parole. Kearney's never going to parole because he is a serial killer as well as a sexual sadist. He's a man. He has a whole freaking laundry list of what he is. They're not going to let this creep out. And he's going to die in prison. He's 85 years old or something close to that. And that's the end of the story with this guy.
Yeah. Yeah, it pisses me off that he's still alive. You know, it's an equalizer. Like, I'm sure Kearney wanted to be 6'5". At some point, and was jealous of guys, you know, guys that are size, that are, you know, bigger size guys. But I'm not going to live to 85. I can almost guarantee your heart just can't pump that much blood. So, you know, if you ever have a short man's complex, just realize you're going to live to 90 and enjoy it. Logistically speaking, why throw trash bags full of body parts out of the car window? Wouldn't it be maybe more efficient or covert to bury them or throw them into ravines or something?
Well, that's exactly what he did. He didn't just throw out the window of the car. He took them to the desert, threw the bodies, and disposed of them there. Others, he cut into little parts. He buried under his house, which was the case with George. Others, he took to San Juan Capistrano. And he found, the police found the bodies because he told them where he left them. But he placed them there. He just didn't throw them out of a car. This guy actually placed them there. And like with I said with John LeMay, he made mistakes. His jealousy that David Hill brought a person to his house, a boy, who obviously, and he responded by shooting him. Well, what he didn't know was, of course, that boy had told friends that he was going to a guy named Dave's house. And there was an address, actually, to a white stucco house where he lived. Police just immediately zoomed in on him. He made mistakes. So as smart as he is, he cannot control the one thing that you and I have been talking about for about 2 years now, Matt, and that is impulse. Kearney had an impulse to kill. And the jealousy mixed with all those things that excited him made him act. And that last murder cost him everything because he was caught right after that.
The fag in the bag thing really pisses me off because you know, not in any way that they're asking for it, but these aren't 45-year-old lifers, you know, bar flies that you're talking about. These are 17, 18, 19-year-old kids, you know, to act like they don't matter, especially a young person like that, is really, that's just piggish behavior on a whole other level.
Well, yeah, and you're right about that. Most of the victims were teens. Let me just give you a quick rundown of the ages. 1962, 19. 1916, a guy named Mike was 18. George, who was found under the house of Kearney's home, there's a good indication of a teenager. John Demick, 13. James Fletcher, 17. Ronald Dean Smith, 5 years of age. Albert Rivera, 21. Keenan Eugene, 17. Oliver Peter, 13. Larry Armandias, 13. Michael McGee, 13. Most of these kids were 16, 19, 17, some 27, some 20s. But this guy, his list of known kills are in the 30s. And for police officers, law enforcement to refer to them as fags in bags or fag in the bag murders, it tells you the type of mentality in the 70s when it came to law enforcement. And a lot of these serial killers went on for decades, because once police recognized that sex workers were involved or people of the homosexual LGBTQ community, this is the type that happened. They turned a blind eye. It's not that important. Other cases got priorities. And we've seen it happen before. Look at the Gilgo murders. It's a big thing with the chief police and the DA over there, because the chief police was a freaking, my God, he was a pervert. They found duffel bags of child pornography and stuff. He took the attention off the Gilgo murders, and they had the evidence to find out who he was already. But he spent so much time covering his own crimes that it took 10 more years to catch this guy. This also happens in the 70s and 80s when law enforcement didn't share information, or their attitude was the fag in the bag. It's just, it's bad, it's terrible, and I'm sure we can connect a number of murders to that time frame that would have been solved and Kearney would have been caught had a better and more disciplined investigation took place that actually prioritized these individuals who were being murdered by Kearney and not thrown off as fags in bags.
Yeah, absolutely. So, we will be back next week. That's the story of Patrick Kearney. He's still alive in Mule Creek Prison. Bill, you have a newsletter.
I do. And lately, we haven't been putting it out that much because I've been writing and my publisher's been putting it. It has not put them out, but we're going to begin very shortly to put them out. There's a lot of stuff you guys got to hear. There are stories about serial killers that no one ever heard before because I actually saw them. And I'm actually putting out a TikTok account. Hopefully, the Chinese don't take that away from us. But there's going to be live audio of me talking, narrative of situations that I saw happen on death row when serial killers were assaulted, they were stabbed, etc. It's good stuff. Be patient. It's going to come. It's going to be there very soon. And I wish you guys would sign up and take a look at it, because there's a lot of good stuff that you've never heard before. And I guarantee it's going to shock you as well as intrigue you.
Definitely check that out. Check us out on Instagram. Check us out on patreon.com/deathrowdiaries. I rarely promote it, but subscribe to my Substack. That is bullseye.substack.com. You will enjoy it. Until next time, I've been Matt Ralston.
And I'm William Nagara. Be safe. Be aware of your surroundings. Your life can depend on it. We'll see you next time.
All righty.